Hello and welcome to the Android Central podcast for Thursday, October 10th, 2019. It is 5 days away from the Made by Google event. And joining me this week, Andrew Martinick and Hayato Huseman.
Oh my goodness.
All about it.
It's happening. It's our hair isn't on fire yet, but it's darn close.
We're almost there.
It's happening. GIF, I think, is appropriate right now.
Yeah, it's finally, it feels in many ways like it's already happened, let's be honest, as we'll get to.
That's but, fair. You know, I think that's
there,
fair.
There are some things left to reveal.
Andrew, what do you mean? I have no idea what we're expecting next week.
Have you been on the internet?
Do you know they have the internet on computers now?
Oh, do they? That's interesting.
If it didn't happen on a guitar, Hayato doesn't know anything about it.
Yeah, you know,
do you write your stories on guitar? Like, do you have like a translation?
So I've got this MIDI mapped guitar. I could probably map out like each fret to be a different key on the keyboard if I really wanted to. But that sounds terrible.
That sounds awesome. Actually, I think you should do it and then film yourself writing up a story about doing that while doing it on your guitar.
As long as you don't mind it being like 6 days late. We can probably do that.
Well, what else is new?
Dang.
Whoa.
Shots fired early on.
Got to do it. All right, let's start. Where do you want to start? Do you want to start with Pixel first and then go to the lesser of the products? Or do you want to start with the lesser of the products and then work our way up?
Ooh.
I'm easy.
I like the non-phone parts. Let's not call them lesser. Let's talk about the non-phone parts first.
Okay. I feel like lesser is appropriate, not because they're like worse products. I just think that by like interest level, most people are not showing up on Tuesday for the Nest, you know, the Nest Home Mini 2 or whatever it's called, you know? But yeah, that's fair. That's fair. Okay. Let's actually start there because why not? So today, 9to5 Google leaked the official name of the new Nest Home Mini or the Google Home Mini 2. It'll just be called the Nest Mini. It's probably going to be a very minor update from a product that hasn't received an update since 2017. And, you know, Google gives these away like, I don't know, like pills. Like everybody I know has
included
like
everywhere.
Four of them.
I think the original price is actually $50, which is insane to think about now because they're usually 2 for $40 or they're $25 or you get one for free when you just like look at a Pixel. They hand them out everywhere, which is kind of the whole point of these things, just like the Echo Dot. Just get as many of them out in the world and hope that people will then, you know, buy more of them or buy the larger devices later.
So what's funny is that I have 4 or 5 Nest or Google Home Minis, and 3 of them I got without realizing that I was getting them because they just give them away through signing up for other services. So I got one by being a Spotify premium member. I got one by, I think, just buying a Pixel 3. I got one in the mail like 6 weeks later. And then I went to some event to do with my bank. So something, nothing to do with tech. And they gave out a Google Home Mini at the end because Google was a sponsor of that event. So
weird.
So weird. Like this thing just showed up over the last 2 years everywhere you go. And obviously, this is Google's major competitor to the Echo Dot. And you know, the Echo Dot is it's a pretty reliable speaker. But Andrew, as you found, you know, when you went to Seattle to Amazon's event a couple of weeks ago, Amazon has like 10 different versions of that dot now, including something that you just plug into the wall.
And I didn't think that I would. I'm just now thinking about this. The Echo Dot with clock is like stealthily the best update they've done to that product, adding that little dot matrix clock to it because. And I juxtapose that to the Google Home Mini, which was supposed to have these touch controls, and they end up disabling them later because they were such a disaster. And on top of that, it doesn't have any other interface other than audio. And I would, now I'm like, you know, this Nest Mini probably should have one of these little dot matrix clocks on it, and it's not going to have that. And that's kind of annoying.
Well, we don't really know what it looks like. We haven't seen any leaks of the actual product yet.
It feels like that would be something that would have been leaked, but if it has the clock, I will applaud it. But if it doesn't, then it's like, okay, Amazon plus 1 point. On top of the fact that they now have the Echo Flex, like you said, that just plugs straight into the wall as well.
Weird. So, I mean, what else could this have to differentiate it from the Home Mini? I guess like it shouldn't be broken from the beginning.
Yeah.
Right? Like bare minimum, just don't have to shut off an entire feature before it even ships.
Yeah, perhaps the touch controls would work.
Why don't you remind people if they don't remember exactly what happened with that?
So it used to, the Google Home Mini, right when it came out, you used to be able to tap it different numbers of times on the top to control things. Like you could do play, pause, or you could use that to activate it rather than saying the phrase. And then you could move the volume up and down by sliding across the top and things like that. But the way that the touch interacted with the fabric on the Home Mini meant that it was just activated all the time. And so it was recording all the time, and people didn't realize it at first. And, you know, that's kind of a bad thing to do when people are already slightly skeptical of these things, recording them all the time. And so they had to push software updates that turned off almost all the touch functionality, except for now I think you could still tap on the sides for the volume, and
I use that all the time.
That's hilarious. So yeah, maybe making the product work as intended out of the box would be a good start for the Nest Mini.
That was such an embarrassment, honestly. It was it's easy to forget now because it's been 2 years, but that was such a disaster for Google at the time. It was the company's second smart speaker. It was a big, big release, right? It was, you know, the Google Home was $130. This was going to be $50, super accessible. And even before it, you know, it reaches consumers. I mean, this was a shipping product. Like, they had to release a day one patch to remove functionality.
Right, because this was discovered during like the review period.
Yeah,
when it was first
from Android Police was the first person who discovered it.
And the interesting thing there as well was between the original Home and the Home Mini, like the touch controls are so much cooler and better looking than the kind of clunky buttons on an Echo.
Yeah,
and you're like, wow, it's really cool. You can slide your finger across, and then it just didn't work at all.
Yeah. So yeah, I mean, whatever this has, it just needs to work out of the box and it'll be a better product. So go Google. Also, let's like talk briefly about how everything's a Nest product and why.
Why? This is what we were just talking about before we started. So it's the Nest Mini, but
well, yeah, Mini probably. One. I mean, we don't know for sure.
I mean,
but it's,
that's either way, it just sounds weird. It sounds a lot. It already sounds kind of weird with the Nest Hub Max, but that was already kind of a weird name as it was. But this transition period is going to be real awkward because we're not hearing rumors of a refreshed Google Home or a Google Home Max. It's just the Mini, but then they're all kind of still in this continuum of Google Assistant speakers.
So here's the interesting thing, right? This is a very simple product, and I think Google understands that the next generation of its speaker lineup needs to be focused on screens because it's Google and they need to show you information, right? So the Nest Hub Max received rave reviews. The Nest Hub has been well received as well. I don't see them releasing a new standard Google Home, because if they did, it would just be nearly the same price as a Nest Hub. And while the Nest Hub doesn't have a great speaker, I think they probably have a lot of data to show that if you want a good sounding speaker, you're probably going to be okay spending a bit more money.
Get like a Sonos or something.
Well, no, even like a you know, Amazon is the exception here because it just throws everything at the wall and sees what sticks. But, you know, Google is probably being a bit more conservative and being like, okay, well, we have the Google Home Max if you want like a really big boomy speaker. We have the Nest Hub Max if you want a decent sounding speaker that's also a really good smart display. And then we still sell the Google Home if you want something that is just a speaker. And it still sounds great. Like, I use it all the time. It's fine. Mm-hmm. It does the job. So maybe they're not in a rush to replace a three-year-old product. And it does speak to the fact that the replacement cycles for this category is just nowhere near as quick as a smartphone.
I think that's totally fine because I still get a ton of use out of my Google Home Minis all the time. I mean, same kind of deal as you. I've got like four or five of them and I've just started like gifting them to my friends. But the one or two that I do have sitting around, like that's my default music player, even though it's not the best sounding just because it's really simple. It's really easy. And, you know, you just kind of leave it in a room and you don't really think about it.
I mean, the other thing too, is that there's a rumor that there's going to be a new Google Wi-Fi, which will be essentially a built-in Google Home speaker, or at least a Nest.
Yeah, this is the weirder one. And potentially more interesting, I suppose, just from like a, this is actually a new kind of product. But the rumor points to a mesh Wi-Fi system. So you'll have several of these things, you know, hopefully two or three. And then each one will be a Google Assistant speaker. So it's kind of two for one in that it encourages you to keep them out rather than kind of stashing them away as you typically would with mesh routers, even though, you know, no matter how nice you make it look, it's still a router. So you would presumably get better Wi-Fi coverage and each one of them would kind of listen in, which is similar to the Amazon approach. And you could easily see Amazon doing this considering they're just putting Alexa in everything anyway. But this is really... Oh, yeah, I know. My phone is listening to me. Okay, quiet. you could easily see Amazon doing this with Eero and what they already do with their, oh, goodness, all of the different Echoes, but the Echo Flex and Echo Dot in particular. The question is, like, where's the priority? It obviously has to be a router first and a well-performing router at that, considering that, you know, these are going to be presumably expensive, just like most mesh routers are. So how do you try to, you know, how do you try to justify the size and the design of it to also include all this assistant stuff? Like, how good of a speaker can it be when it's supposed to be a router first?
I don't think it needs to be a good speaker. I just think it's another avenue for Google Assistant, you know, in rooms that may not have it previously. What's interesting is, you know, Google has been pushing Google Assistant into the living room through Amazon, through Android TV for a while. So this may just become an instance where you might have two or even three Google Assistant speakers in your living room, because most people's main routers are in near their, you know, either where their cable comes in or where their fiber node comes in. For me, that's in my living room. I would assume most people have the same thing, although some do stash their routers in their basements and whatnot. But most houses I've been to have the router pretty, you know, central. So it's interesting that Google would add this functionality knowing there may be overlap.
Yeah, and it definitely points to a little more of what Amazon's doing and trying to just get the voice assistant in as many places as possible. So you would kind of just think, okay, this is just going to put Google Assistant in more places, and hopefully it wouldn't double up too much with your existing array of Google Assistant speakers. See, this is the problem. Now it's going to be like their Nest speakers and Google Homes, and you don't know what to call them. But the real cool stuff happens with what is Google going to do to compete with Amazon's already strong pitch for how you use these devices between all the rooms. Like, obviously Google Assistant speakers can do room grouping, and they can do this new thing where you can hand off your audio stream between different rooms now. But Google doesn't really have the same type of pitch that Amazon does with, they really play up their room-to-room calling and the intercom system and the drop-in and all that sort of stuff. Google Assistant doesn't really compete on that same level yet.
So the other thing that Amazon did with the Eero was it brought the price down. You know, the Eero Pro was like a $399 product. The Eero Mesh, which launched last week, is now a $299 product to compete with Google Wi-Fi, or yeah, whatever it's called. You wonder, like, Google isn't going to be supporting Wi-Fi 6. At least the rumors don't support, at least the rumors don't indicate that. So is this going to be a premium, like $399 refresh, or is it just going to replace the existing one? And if so, you know, how do they make it better? What's the avenue there aside from Assistant? Like, I don't know. It sounds...
Yeah, that's the interesting thing, because Google Wi-Fi came out at this premium point kind of when mesh Wi-Fi was moving into just the complete consumer space. And then Google Wi-Fi price dropped to now you get them for like $90 or $100 a piece, and they're relatively cheap. They're the same price as the new cheaper Eero's. Do they go back up all of a sudden to being $150 a piece and they're kind of expensive again? And how can you justify that? I'm not sure if this, each of the nodes is a now a Google Assistant speaker thing, is really enough to make somebody make that move.
Yeah, I don't know. I love the idea of improving Wi-Fi in homes. And I think Google and Eero and all the others like Netgear and TP-Link and all the other mesh router solutions have done a great job. But at the same time, like, Wi-Fi is actually really hard. And it's, you know, for a lot of people who have access to higher speeds, like I have... You know, I know this is a good problem to have, but I have gigabit at home through fiber to the node. No mesh routers come close to providing that much. You know, the Eero taps out at like 350 megabits.
But I think the more important thing about things like Google Wi-Fi is that it's not necessarily about the speeds or anything. It's also like it's really simple to set up for anybody. You basically just, you know, you plug in straight from the modem, and it's like it's pretty much set up right there for you through an app with like a really simple UI.
Totally. And yeah, no, that's what I'm saying. They've solved the pain point of having to like dig into your settings to set up your router, right? Like the days of like the Linksys, you know, 802.11g, like, you know, you need to install Tomato because you know, you just want to eke as much power from your single router, you know, access point as possible. Like, that's gone. You don't need to worry about that. It's the equivalent of like, you don't need to root your phone anymore because it just works. Now we're looking for, how does the mesh router ecosystem evolve from here? Do you add features vertically on top of it, like what Google's planning on doing by introducing Assistant, or do you just make it a better mesh system? You know, Google can't help itself. It has to add features to its products that people may or may not need. And I'm worried that that's going to happen here.
Well, part of it is also just getting a fresh product, and in their case, with their new name, to fit the rest of the Nest brand, because not like market penetration for mesh systems is not high. There's still so much market out there for people that still have the single router. Like, sure, it's not a WRT54G router anymore. It's probably something provided by their internet provider, or, you know, something like that. They have whatever, you know, Best Buy $80 special router. And getting them onto mesh is the same pitch as it was 3 years ago when the first Google Wi-Fi came out. It's just now it's going to be a fresh version. And I don't think they may not have a huge pitch for improved speeds or having Wi-Fi 6, but they don't need that to gain market. The market is still just like there for getting people to understand that they can have way better internet in their homes or internet access in their homes from a mesh router system. And so adding some kind of a simple, more like consumery feature makes more, you know, can make more of a difference than talking about speeds or coverage.
Yeah, exactly. I guess that's my concern is like, it has to eventually evolve to keep up with home internet speeds. But at the same time, most people don't have gigabit. They just want stable bandwidth, stable coverage throughout their home.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like I know our colleague Joe Maring, he lives in an apartment complex where Comcast took over from, like they bought the contract over from what was the other one?
Spectrum, I think.
Spectrum, yeah. So he went from having like unlimited bandwidth to 200 gigabits a month, to 200 gigabytes a month with 300 megabits a second. And it's like, that sucks. Like if you don't have a choice, all you want is just decent Wi-Fi with a reliable internet connection. So yeah, I'm excited about the future. I don't think this is going to be the solution for me though.
Like you said, this is not going to be this will probably be the least exciting part of the Google event.
Yeah, they may not even talk about it. We spent more time talking about it than they probably will. All right, let's move on. Let's talk.
We're nerds.
What else? Okay, so we talked about the Nest Mini. We talked about the router. Let's do Pixel Buds.
Really quickly.
Yeah, let's talk.
Because know the least amount of them.
We know nothing least about them. We don't think, I mean, they're not going to be wired. At least we have to assume that they're going to be wireless, right? They have to be true wireless earbuds.
And hopefully they look better than the Surface earbuds.
Well, that's a pretty low bar.
The big thing that I pointed out in my little preview after, really, I liked the original Pixel Buds, but they were, you know, they just made critical basic mistakes in trying to do cool stuff with the design, with the little adjustable loop that was really cool. They ended up having this cord behind them. And in trying to do the Google Assistant stuff and the live translation and focusing on that, they kind of whiffed on the case being too big and not very practical. Like, I just hope that the Pixel Buds 2 will just focus on being like good wireless headphones and not try to do like stupid googly features, because those probably aren't going to work well anyway. Just make them a good pair of headphones first and don't have a bunch of compromises. That would be pretty fantastic. Will that happen? Probably not. They'll try to come up with some cool feature and charge $200 for them.
I mean, at the same time though, like if they just make them good headphones, like yeah, they'd be great, but then why would you buy them over, you know, something like Galaxy Buds or any of the other already existing?
Because Google, I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't think so. Not for something like not for something like earbuds. I mean, Microsoft is even doubling down on the fact that they don't expect a lot of people to buy the Surface Buds. Like these are earbuds for people who love Office, you know, who want to present Windows, you know, on Windows with PowerPoint using their voice. Like it's a very specific market. They're going for those people and Daniel Rubino, right? Like two very niche categories. If you look back at the Pixel Buds, the marketing around that was Fast Pair, right? It was the first.
And Fast Pair was awesome.
Fast Pair, yeah. It was the first headphones with Fast Pair, which eventually came to every Google Assistant powered pair of headphones. It was the first with onboard Google Assistant, which could be, you know, easily activated by holding your finger, holding your finger onto the right earbud, and it just
now
worked.
Totally commoditized.
Now every headphone has a Google Assistant button, right? So you don't need that. Also, the implementation on that, you can't, once you activate Google Assistant on your headphones on Android, you have to at least allow it to give you notification pings when you get a notification. You can't turn it off completely. You actually have to physically disable Google Assistant on the headphones. So yeah. It's just a bit too in your face, but like in your ear. about
That's what I'm talking about. Like, who can, like, those features are so basic and kind of frustrating for some people too. I would totally use the Pixel Buds again, even the original ones, if they just even with the cord, if they just re-released them with better touch controls and a smaller charging case. Like, those are the things that matter, the basics.
The other thing was, yeah, the sound was okay, but you accidentally played and paused your music by removing them because the touch controls were too sensitive. As you said, the case was garbage. It was way too big, and you had to loop the cord around the edge of the case, yeah,
which put a kink in it by design. So there was always a kink in the cable, and the case was fabric.
It was too
that thing got nasty.
You know, it was like, oh, we're having a fabric year, folks. Like, everything that year was fabric. The Google Home
everything
Mini
looked
was fabric.
Like sweatpants.
Yeah, it was a really it was hugely disappointing. I really wanted to like the Pixel Buds, and I actually tried them again. I was writing an editorial last week about them.
Oh, really?
Them. And I tried them again.
Are they still bad?
Oh, they're horrible. They're terrible. One thing that 9to5 Google found was that the next pair of Pixel Buds will have a hands-free Google Assistant. So you won't have to touch them to activate it. You'll just be able to say, like, hey, G, and it'll just work.
Cool. But how? Yeah, okay. It has to all come in addition to fixing the base problems.
Right. And in the last in the intervening 2 years, the true wireless earbud category has exploded. Like, the Galaxy Buds are $130. The Echo Buds are $130. The upcoming Jabra Elite 75Ts, which are arguably going to be the best true wireless earbuds ever made. And I'm going to put my stake in the ground and actually say that, because I think they will be. They have a tiny case. They're going to be super comfortable, and they're going to cost like $180. I just got a pair of the Anker Soundcore Liberty 2 Pros, and they're $150. They're incredible. They're amazing. Like, all of these companies are releasing really, really good true wireless earbuds.
Yeah. Although that is an interesting point, because the thing about the Pixel Buds, the original ones, was we were like, wow, these are $160. That's really expensive. And also they had problems. But we've kind of been acclimatized to the idea of $150+ wireless earbuds. So they could really come around with a sequel that could justify the price in the way that last generation couldn't. Because maybe, just the market wasn't really accustomed to that yet.
And then there was the universal translation feature, which was so much worse than they claimed it would be, that I just don't think anybody had time for it. So that's that.
That is that. I realized we spent too long on the Pixel Buds already.
No, I look, I'm a huge fan of of headphones. Like, I love talking headphones. I could talk headphones forever. I like the fact that, Apple, Google, and Microsoft are all competing in the headphone space now, because they understand that assistance plus ears equals, profit, right? It's easy to talk to your assistant if the headphone is just in your ear. That's great. And if it works, even better. But it doesn't work all the time, and Google has to do better, because...
Mm-hmm.
They didn't. All right. Okay. So before we go to Pixel 4, let's talk Pixel Book Go. We don't know a lot about this yet, other than it will be a smaller, presumably cheaper version of the Pixel Book.
And it's going to be way more, it's kind of going to split the difference between the high end, really fancy design Pixel Book and the tried too hard and completely failed convertible Pixel Slate.
Right. So reports point to a 13.3-inch 4K display, metal body, and options for a range of processors from an Intel M3 up to a Core i7. So the Pixel Book was $999 when it launched. That was the entry-level SKU. The Pixel Slate was, $499? But that SKU never actually launched, or $599.
Yeah, so $599 was the way it was the thing plus the keyboard,
which was like another $130, $150.
It was overpriced.
So what's your take on this? I mean, if it's the Pixel Book is not a big laptop, it's not a heavy laptop, like calling it the Pixel Book Go makes it, you know, implies based on the nomenclature that it's a less expensive, more portable version of the Pixel Book, doesn't it?
It does. And I mean, it's not a very inventive name, but it kind of gets the point across. If this ends up being something that launches, for example, at $599, you know, clear separation between it and the Pixel Book, you know, Pixel Book Prime, whatever you want to call it, would be really good. That means that in when you look at maybe higher configurations with a bunch of RAM and a Core i7, like the top Pixel Book Go still tops out, you know, $100 underneath the starting Pixel Book, something like that, would be a great, you know, price range for this thing.
Okay, yeah, and you know, I think the Pixel Book, I just think they want to reclaim some of the goodwill from its laptop line, because the Chromebook Pixel was great. Both generations were awesome. The Pixel Book, still, I think, one of the best laptops ever made. Like, ever made. It has not lowered in value in my eyes since it was released 2 years ago. And it speaks to how well Google built it in the first place and how well they've maintained Chrome OS throughout those 2 years. So, but what's interesting is like a 4K display, it can't be a $599 computer on a 4K display. You know, I think they'll have to come out with like a 1080p display for the entry level SKU and then go up to a 4K.
Yeah, I mean, especially if it's running an M3.
Oh, yeah, big time.
I think as long as they keep every model, or at least most models, under $1,000, like that's really all they need to do, because the original Pixel Book was super nice, but a lot of people, once you get into the four-figure range, it's like, you know, even people that like Chromebooks, it gets a little difficult to justify over a Windows or a Mac laptop for, you know, close to the same money at that point.
And the Pixel Slate did theoretically have a low starting price, but it was trash.
Yeah.
And the one that made it reasonable was like $1,000+, or about $1,000. So they need something that actually provides a little bit of value. And I agree with Daniel that the Pixel Book is still a modern, nice machine. Like, they don't have to replace that. This can slot underneath it.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, so the original leak from 9to5 Google, who has just been killing it, right? I just want to say they have done an amazing job this season, leak season. And they said that there will be all of the models will have a 13.3-inch display, but the entry levels will have a 1080p resolution, and the more powerful ones will have a 4K display. All with the molecular display branding that came with the Pixel Slate. So, you know, the Pixel Slate was trash, but the display was not. The display was amazing.
And the hardware in general was good.
Yeah, yeah, it was. It was just the experience that was garbage.
You know, though, I keep hoping that, like, even though the Pixel Slate was really bad, I really wish that they would put a little bit of focus on making some kind of decent tablet again, just because, like, I've been in the market for some sort of tablet with a good keyboard accessory specifically for flights. You know, like, we do all this traveling and you get on a plane, they won't let you use your laptop no matter what size it is for the first, you know, 15 minutes before they take off, the last 15 minutes before they land. And having a tablet of the exact same size is somehow okay. And I'm like, I could be getting writing done or just do whatever on a tablet.
Re-release the Pixel C. Do it. Just do it, Google.
I love the Pixel C hardware. That would be amazing.
Running Android or running Chrome OS?
I don't care.
I don't care.
Oh my God, you guys are the worst.
I would legitimately, even if it ran Android, I would legitimately use the Pixel C again, even if it was the same hardware with just a new processor and more RAM. That form factor is perfect.
Yeah. Nobody has nailed the whole, like, the keyboard attachment setup the way that the Pixel C did, I think.
Yeah. I think Microsoft is the closest because it has that infinitely adjustable hinge that's part of the tablet. Mm-hmm. I don't like the whole triangle-shaped little flip-out keyboard situation that every other tablet relies on. It just doesn't work the same. Like, the Pixel C has so many issues that are well discussed, but it really did nail that keyboard part. And that's, I think, some of that was why we were so excited about the Pixel Slate. Because like, oh, they're trying to do convertible things again, but they're going to try it again with the Chrome OS, and the hardware looks really nice. And then, like Daniel said, the experience was so bad, much like the Pixel C, actually. But the one thing I'm missing here with the Pixelbook Go is like, man, I wish that they would try something cool again, especially in light of Microsoft's coming out. I mean, we haven't mentioned the Surface Pro X and Surface Pro 7.
Pro
like
X
they're continuing to do this sort of thing. Like, we don't even have to talk about the dual screen stuff. They're continuing to just nail this convertible form factor really, really well. And Google has to fall back on, well, we made really good laptops, and so we'll just keep making a laptop form factor.
Sure, but the issue here is that the tablets, like Microsoft's tablets, are just as useless as the Pixel Slate without a keyboard attachment.
Yep.
Like, Windows 10 is still not optimized for touch. And they even acknowledge that by announcing Windows 10X.
Oh, totally. I don't think they're necessarily great tablets. They're great, laptops 95% of the time, and then the other 5% like tablet in a pinch when you don't need the keyboard.
So I wonder, like, we have some friends in the industry who revisited the Pixel Slate after 6 months or so, reported that it had improved in terms of performance, but it still wasn't where Google probably wanted it. But if you're docking it most of the time with a keyboard and you're not really, really doing much tablet stuff with it, I would venture to say the experience wouldn't be too dissimilar to using any other laptop, any other Chromebook. It's when tablet space. It's when you put it in the tablet form factor is when the Pixel Slate dropped the ball. And that's, again, not too dissimilar to Windows 10. So I don't know if Microsoft's tablets are just held to a different standard, but everybody crapped on the Pixel Slate. Everybody was like, this is garbage.
Rightfully so.
True, but the Surface Pro series, everybody assumes that you're just going to buy the keyboard with it, and I don't know if that's fair.
It's also something that Google has to face with the software part. I mean, it is being very pragmatic about, okay, you're just going to use this as a laptop because like the whole app ecosystems with Android apps on Chrome is so bad still that we just expect you to use it as a laptop anyway.
Yeah, I mean, listen, like the last time I consistently used a Surface was with the Surface Pro 3. So I haven't used a tablet like a 2-in-1 for years. So if you do listen, if you're listening to this and you do use a Surface Pro or any other 2-in-1 and you actually use Windows 10 in tablet mode, let us know. Podcast at Android Central. We'd love to hear from you. All right, let's go to Pixel 4. Well, first we'll take a break because somebody's got to pay for this conversation, and then we'll come back and we'll talk Pixel 4. Be right back. This episode of the Android Central podcast is brought to you by Keeps. So obviously, losing hair sucks. I didn't realize how much I cared about that until I actually started losing it. And, years and years ago, there weren't a lot of things that you could do. Now, that's different. You can use Keeps. It's the easiest and most affordable way to keep the hair you have. So Keeps is really, really smart. It uses FDA-approved products that maintain the hair you have and in some cases help grow some of it back. Starting with Keeps is really easy. All you do is you sign up. It takes about 5 minutes on their website. You answer a few questions and you snap some maybe embarrassing photos of your hair or lack thereof. Then a licensed physician will review your information and recommend the right treatment for you, and then ship it to your door every 3 months. Keeps offers generic versions of the only two FDA-approved hair loss products out there. So some of you may have already tried them before, but I promise you've never gotten them for this price. Keeps is between $10 and $35 a month, depending on which solutions you go for. But you can now get your first month free because that's how Keeps wants to keep you. They want you to try these products yourself. So if you are interested in trying Keeps for 1 month at no charge, you can go to keeps.com/ACP. That's keeps.com/ACP. And you get a free month of treatment at keeps.com/ACP. Keeps, hair today, hair tomorrow. All right, Hayato, you haven't spoken enough on this episode. So what are you looking forward to most about the Pixel 4?
You know, I want to say better battery life, but we all know that's not happening. So I'm going to mostly just say...
You can still say it. It's fine. You can hope.
You said, what am I looking forward to? Not what do I really wish Google would just get right for once.
Oh, fine.
I don't know. I am definitely looking forward to seeing what they do with the cameras, just because that's always the Pixel's thing. And that's, you know, I'm a videographer. That's sort of my thing too. So I would love to see exactly what the camera improvements do in the real world. But other than that, I mean, you know, like I'm glad that they're still putting a focus on smaller phones, even though, you know, the Pixel 4 XL, I'm sure, is going to be still the better phone with the better battery life and et cetera. But I'm looking forward to seeing the regular Pixel 4, even though I don't love the design at all.
Why not?
I think it's just an uglier version of the iPhone 11 Pro, TBH.
Huh.
Fire.
That is a thing that you could say. I mean, I guess so. Like, fine. But it's also like, I think more than anything, it just looks like the Pixel. Like, it looks like the Pixel 3. It looks like the Pixel 2 XL. Like, it just looks
like
the same phone.
Which have never looked particularly groundbreaking.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're just well-executed, simple designs.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, you're right. The same criticism has been leveled at Apple for, what, 10 years now? They keep recycling their designs.
But so, now it's got a big old squircle on the back.
Yeah, I think the 11 Pro is definitely the least good-looking iPhone that I've seen in a while.
Actually, like, even when you look at it in real life?
Yeah, I mean, it's better in person, but it's still, I don't love the look of it at all.
Andrew, what about you? What's most tantalizing about the Pixel 4?
I would love to be excited about the small Pixel, but I just know I'm going to be disappointed. So I just hope that the 4 XL has decent battery life, because I know there's no chance that the 4 will. So I'm mostly just keeping my sights set on the 4 XL. And like I spoke about, I think a few episodes ago, I just want Google to get the basics right on the thing. And that stinks that's where we're at, where it tempers my expectations for all of the extra features they're going to talk about, with the touch-free gestures and the face unlock and, you know, all the camera features. I just want it to be able to, like, function properly without dropping apps and without needing to be charged in the middle of the day. So those are the kind of things that you don't really know until you've used it for longer. And I just fully don't expect the battery life to stand up at all on the small one. So it's like, okay, already resigning to the fact that I have to carry the big one. Now, please just work properly so I can then enjoy, like, the face unlock and things like that.
So there hasn't been a Pixel launch that was bug free, you know, period. Like the first one had problems. The second one, you know, everybody was talking about the terrible display on the XL. The third one, everybody was talking about the fact that you couldn't take a photo with it without it crashing or just.
And also the display was still kind of bad.
What? Sorry?
The display was still kind of bad on the 3 and 3 XL.
I mean, it was.
I thought it was fine.
They were Samsung panels.
Okay. They were fine.
They were fine.
Sure. There were things to point to in every launch, I think is the point.
Right. So, yeah, I guess on a very low level, like Google just needs to nail the launch. They just need to get a phone out the door that doesn't have show-stopping bugs. The good news is that Google has done a ton of work on Android 10. So we know that Android 10 is pretty stable on the Pixel 3. We know that Android 10 is the most mature update that Google's released ever. So, and I've had no issues really with the software. The beta program was long. They had lots of feedback from developers. But somehow, when Google releases a phone, the bugs really just manifest. It's like it's coming from inside the phone. Like it doesn't matter if previous versions have had no issues with software. The hardware just seems to self-destruct.
The interesting thing for me on the software part is I just don't get excited about the Google Assistant stuff on the phone. And I'm not sure if I'm in the minority or what, but there was this leak about a lift to listen thing coming in the Pixel 4. So you know, as soon as you pick up the phone, it's listening and you don't have to, you know, it's just ready to go at all times. And I just don't find myself talking to my phone at all. Just like I never used the squeeze for Assistant on the Pixel 3. And that always seems to be a thing on each Pixel. They just do a different type of Assistant thing. And it's just never appealing to me. And they're going to do it again on the Pixel 4.
I mean, I use Google Assistant all the time for like checking the weather and really simple stuff like that. So I appreciate some kind of quick hardware shortcut, but it's definitely not like a constant usage kind of thing for me either.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, there are a lot of variables here. Like Google is introducing a brand new way to, unlock your phone. So there's a lot of things that could go wrong there. But as we know, they've been using contractors to get as much facial data as possible, in controversial situations. So hopefully it works. We've seen leaked marketing videos of how it works. It seems like it's going to be as seamless as Face ID, which is encouraging.
If so, that's great.
Yeah.
You care about that way more than the touchless gestures, which I just could not care less about. I would love to be blown away by that, but that is something that at best demos well and does not actually hold weight in the real world. So it's also another one of those things that like they're trying to do something different and you're like, man, I really like if you just put a bigger battery in it and then just didn't talk to me about not touching the screen.
Yeah, the irony here is that Apple, despite recycling its hardware design for the third year in a row, added a bigger battery to the iPhones. And everybody's like, yes, finally, make it thicker, make it heavier. We're okay with it. Google doesn't seem to be thinking the same. What about the 90 hertz display?
Oh, I am excited for that.
Yeah, I mean, like I've been enjoying it on the OnePlus 7T and the 7 Pro. It really does change the way you use your phone.
Yeah. Switching from the OnePlus 7T over to the Galaxy Fold for the last week, it's like the Fold is such a cool phone in so many ways that the 7T is great, but a little boring. But then even with that being the case and like having this foldable display and all kinds of crazy stuff about the Fold, I'm always frustrated when I like turn my 7T back on and look at that 90 hertz display and think that this phone that costs almost three times as much just doesn't have that.
It's kind of going to become the next standard thing. I mean, I think we've talked about this before too. There isn't a ton, you know, there's not a ton new under the sun in display technology. Everybody's gone OLED and you know, they're all pretty bright and colorful and have good viewing angles. So the next kind of thing is, can you do 90 Hertz or in some cases 120 Hertz and, you know, make it not tank the battery or cause, you know, graphical problems. And I love that OnePlus is standardized on it because it looks so good. I would be shocked if Samsung's next round of phones didn't go 90 Hertz as well.
And on the 7T, I have really, really good battery life, even with 90 Hertz enabled.
Yeah, they went down to 1080p, and that seems to have made a big difference.
Yeah. But then, you know, it's, if we're looking at 90 Hertz on the Pixel, I mean, the battery life is already hopeless. So what's that going to do?
Hopeless is a good way to put it. And you're like, okay, so do we just lean into it and just drain as much battery as possible? And you're like, well, at least it looks good.
Yeah.
Or do you think, oh man, I would definitely give up this nice looking 90 Hertz to get another 45 minutes of battery life out of this. Cause you know, I really need that. But for me, it really does also come back to, like, do you get the basics right? Is this a display that, I mean, obviously I had a bigger problem with the Pixel 3 and 3 XL's displays than you guys did, but like they were fine. Are you going to go to a 90 Hertz display on the 4 and 4 XL, but is it still going to be like way too dim and reflective and gross in direct sunlight? Like, I would much rather have a Note 10 display that's super bright and really viewable in direct sunlight than giving that up to get 90 Hertz. Like, do you go all the way and actually give me a great display from top to bottom? I think that the OnePlus 7 Pro's display is not much of a trade-off. I think it's pretty good all the way around. So if they could just match that, of course, in a phone that's going to be $200 to $300 more, like, yeah, you should be able to do that.
I guess it's one of those problems that every manufacturer is facing. How do you make your product stand out? How do you make your, you know, a Pixel 4 stand out? I mean, we know everything that's going to launch with it unless they somehow kept some of the features hidden, but it's unlikely. I mean, we know the camera is going to be
doubtful.
The selling point for the hardcore users. We know that motion sense is going to get people in the door because it's really, really interesting. And Google is good at marketing this stuff. So there's the possibility that this phone will launch, or these phones will launch on three of the four US carriers, potentially even all of the major US carriers. What does that do for the Pixel? Does it finally get it to hit critical mass? Or is it still priced too high compared to what it needs to be to compete with the iPhone and the Galaxy S series?
I think kind of both, right?
I don't think that one thing can just, like, just having wider retail availability can just fix it. I think that all of the things we just talked about, the kind of baggage of the Pixel name, you know, some rightfully so and others kind of, you know, maybe a little over the top and too critical, but that baggage of the Pixel name has kind of weighed it down. You know, that's, and just having it available in more carrier stores doesn't just remove that.
Yeah, I mean, that's absolutely right. I just, you know, Google has an outsized influence from a mindshare perspective, and we keep talking about this, but how does it end up translating into sales? At what point are we going to talk about, if ever, Google having a successful product, not just a good product?
Well, that's kind of my point, is like the product has to be good. I think that's where it comes from. If you were to take the 3 and 3XL, you know, put the 3A series aside because it came out so much later, just the 3 and 3XL, and you say it's available on Amazon on day one, and it's available from all four major carriers in the US, and like they had the logistics of it nailed. That's just more people finding out that it's an incomplete, flawed product with issues. Like, that doesn't, you can't parlay that into a successful Pixel 4 launch. It takes multiple generations of releasing good products without this stigma that they have critical hardware and execution problems.
So I'm gonna play our devil's advocate on behalf of the audience here. For 6 months after the Pixel 3 came out, it was our top phone on our best Android phones list until the Galaxy yep. S10 Plus came out in March. How can you square that? How can you say the Pixel 3 was the best phone for most people for 6 months, but also it was so flawed and so problematic?
Definitely. We still, I think the best way to explain it is we still greatly appreciated the philosophy of the software, and the camera was so far ahead of everything else that's where you square that, basically. You could definitely argue that it wasn't the case, and there's a reason why the Galaxy S10 Plus took over and immediately, because it's just a better overall product. That does not mean that the Pixel 3 and 3 XL didn't have problems.
So, okay. So then I know this is jumping the gun, but if the phones don't have those endemic problems from the beginning, if the camera is just as good as the Pixel 3, if not, you know, better, it should be better, or it's just as good as the iPhone 11. If it nails the software fundamentals, which it should, if the Face ID stuff works, is it probably going to be your favorite new phone? Do you see anything undoing that?
It needs the execution, but if it does, then absolutely. And you notice that none of those things had to do with retail availability or what carrier you can get it from.
Right.
You know, like the execution has to be there. All of these things, the reason why, you know, I don't care about the, you know, hands-off gestures or even necessarily how great the face unlock is or whatever. Like, you just execute on the things that we know that the Pixel, like, philosophy is all about. And that's what you need to do. Like, it doesn't have to be anything particularly new. It just has to do the things we expect it to well. And yeah, it can be on the top of the heap without question. That's a pretty big if.
Let's just quickly talk about some of these newly revealed camera features, because some of them are quite interesting. So we know that there's an astrophotography feature that will allow you to, you know, to put your Pixel 4 on a tripod, or I think it's even going to come back to the Pixel 3, if I'm not mistaken. And you'll be able to optimize the photo-taking experience for stargazing. There's also a feature that was discovered in a recent leak where you can do dual contrast photos, like photo taking, so you can adjust the exposure and the contrast in a sort of like a horizontal and vertical graph UX, which is interesting. Hey Atsu, what's your take on that? Like, how do you— Google has never been great about giving manual controls to its users. So this seems like they're not giving you a pro mode, but they're sort of throwing you a bone, sort of.
Well, it's almost like they're breaking pro mode into, you know, separate features instead of just giving you a huge list of, you know, like kind of overwhelming things for most people.
Mm-hmm.
I think like Samsung and Huawei and a bunch of other brands are really good about giving you, like, you know, manual exposure, manual focus, manual everything. But if you don't already know how to use a camera, that's all just really confusing. So I think it's probably a good idea that Google's just kind of breaking these different things into separate features. Like, I'm really excited for the astrophotography feature, just because I like taking a lot of— I don't get to do it very often because phones aren't always great at that, but I like taking a lot of, like, you know, like starry sky photos at night, especially because I live somewhere where there's pretty minimal like light pollution from the city. So it's like you can get a lot of like star visibility in the sky if you go to the right spots. And I want to try that with the Pixel 4 for sure. I don't know. I think it's just it makes more sense than dumping all these confusing features onto like just a one window in the camera UI.
So a couple of other things in the new camera app, which is it actually available now on the Pixel line, Pixel 3, Pixel 2, if you want to try to install it. There's a new social share feature, so you can quickly share your photo to Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, whatever. There's a better framing UI, so it'll allow you to take straighter photos. And there's this new one that was released or unveiled today called Frequent Faces, where it'll identify people that you take photos of regularly, and it will try to focus and keep focus on those people, prioritizing them over other people or subjects in the frame. Andrew,
that seems crazy.
That's an interesting addition. So privacy advocates are going to be concerned about this, obviously, but Google apparently will be deleting face data as soon as you disable it, and it's stored all locally, so nothing is shared in the cloud. But it is something that, you know, only kind of Google would get away with, I think.
And it's also, making it based on specific faces is definitely kind of a Googly thing, because there are plenty of other camera, smartphone cameras that do face tracking autofocus, where it identifies that there is a face, like there is a person in a frame, and it can do tracking autofocus for photos and videos based on the person's face. And so that's normal, but it seems like kind of a niche thing to pick out specific people in crowds of people and focus on them. I kind of want to see how that actually works in the real world.
Like, if you've ever messed with the faces feature in Google Photos, like, Google's really, really good at picking up like specific people. Like, it'll pull in pictures from like 6 years ago where the person looks totally different. And it always knows who it is.
It's definitely a flex of their facial recognition algorithms, because I agree, they are really good. I just mean, what is the situation, the real world situation under which you want your camera to make sure that it's focusing on a specific person, and how does that differ from a photo where it doesn't do that? What's that side by side going to look like? You can see that there could be some interesting ideas there. I don't really see that they would get too much privacy pushback. It sounds like they're going to be doing it properly, especially considering that, like Hayato said, this stuff is already stored in Google Photos anyway.
Right. It's really just an extension of that.
Right.
So a couple of other things. There's a rumor that Google will store depth data, so that because there will be two camera sensors, there will be actual depth data, not just the dual pixel kind that was found on the Pixel 2 and 3, which is interesting because other apps may be able to manipulate that depth data. And
I want that. That's one thing that I can see Google making another big leap is portrait mode, because they did so well with it with one camera. And as we were doing our camera comparisons with the iPhone 11 and the Pixel 3, like, the Pixel 3 was still doing a better job in some cases than the iPhone, and the iPhone has multiple lenses. Mm-hmm. And is brand new. So if they can actually, you know, get real depth data, you could see them jumping ahead again.
Right, exactly. Yeah, I mean, that's kind of it. Like, there's other rumors of there being a pro session availability, so that you may be able to get one-on-one setup and help for your Pixel phone, similar to how they launched on-device help and like tips and tricks with an actual person a couple of years ago. There is a brand new assistant that will be debuting on the Pixel 4, including a raise to talk feature. So you pick up your phone and you can have access to the assistant right away. That's, you know, we saw a demo of this, Andrew, at I/O, and it was amazing. It was probably the highlight of the keynote for me. Where, you know, a Google employee is just there, they were probably holding a prototype Pixel 4 and they were just talking, you know, open camera, take a photo, order an Uber, check the weather. Like, they were just going through these features one by one by one, and everything was instant because it's all done on the phone itself. That is really, really cool.
That's the one thing that could make me want to start talking to my phone, is if it really does work that quick and there isn't this kind of pause and response situation. If it really is real time and conversational, that could make a huge difference for usability of that.
Right. And then there's that neural core, the mm-hmm. replacement, or you know, rumored replacement of the Pixel Visual Core. Jerry wrote a great editorial about the neural core and how that could be helping, you know, that could help improve photo quality. We don't really know much about it other than it's on the spec sheet.
And that was some, like, the Pixel Visual Core was really exciting. And then I don't really think we got the full realization of how useful that was or wasn't in making the Pixel 3's camera so good.
Right, because it was only activated in third-party apps that were
right.
using HDR Plus, not in the main camera app. So it was never really clear how effective and useful it was. You're right. Kind of strange. Still, to this day, mm-hmm. Google has been pretty tight-lipped about it.
And it's also something that, like, we kind of just, all we care about is what the camera can do. It doesn't really matter, you know, how it happens or what part of the silicon it's on, or if it's on an individual chip, or it's just something that they worked with Qualcomm on to have it be part of the Snapdragon SoC. It doesn't really matter. What we really care about is, you know, what does that enable in the camera?
And then finally, there have been rumors of a 5G Pixel that will either debut next week alongside the other two, or next year, perhaps, later on when 5G is a bit more mature. What's your take on that? Because I don't think they should launch a 5G version this year. I don't think they need to even mention 5G.
Battery life on that one is going to be amazing.
Why?
in a not amazing way.
Oh, okay. The sarcastic version of amazing.
Well, I agree. They shouldn't mention it at all, because it's just would become a distraction, and the 5G networks just aren't ready yet. And a couple weeks ago in San Diego, I got to see some fresh 5G demos, because Qualcomm has 5G testing networks on their campus, and their campus is a big, you know, kind of spread out low-rise office park situation, kind of as ideal as possible for testing 5G. And they showed a lot of demos of actually reflecting or bouncing millimeter wave around corners and things like that, bouncing off of buildings and other surfaces to propagate millimeter wave. And even in those ideal conditions, at Qualcomm, working with, I believe it was Verizon in this case, network, it works, but it doesn't work perfectly, and it doesn't really propagate the way that you would expect it to. And it's like, this is the best case scenario, and they show that it does work, but we're talking about this happening at the end of September. And it's just not out there yet. We're going to be talking about this time next year, maybe being available in ways that you could actually go use it without caveats.
Yeah, no doubt.
Can we just agree that, like, millimeter wave is not the right thing to be focusing on? Like, it really, the only 5G really worth putting any energy into at this point is still sub 6?
Right now, yeah. Yeah, I agree.
Unless you're at a football game and you're around, like, thousands of other people, millimeter wave does not work. It's really meant for really dense environments with line of sight to the tower and an enormous capacity, and you know, shopping malls, stadiums, wide open spaces. That's where millimeter wave is perfect. Literally in any other condition, millimeter wave is completely useless, almost useless.
And this gets back to the discussion about the Pixels, is like, the thing holding back the Pixels is not going to be a lack of 5G. it's going to be this huge list of things that like you either have to like have for the first time, or you've had, you know, they've had them for a long time and not executed well. Like the basic, a lot of the basic things and some of these new camera features and things like that. It's not going to be, there's not going to be a single person that skips buying the Pixel just because it doesn't have 5G. So introducing like that separate 5G SKU is not, it shouldn't be a top of mind for Google. And it wouldn't be surprising if that came whatever, 4, 5, 6 months later, kind of like the Pixel 3a did, but it's a 5G version. And we have to remember that 5G versions are carrier specific right now for the most part. So it's going to be in partnership with somebody else, probably Verizon, be honest.
And we keep on bringing up like the basics, the essentials, and harping on things like battery life. But a question for you guys, if the Pixel were, I mean, I'm sure this is not going to be the case with the 4, but maybe, you know, future devices, whatever. If the Pixel were to trade away, get rid of that like really, really good haptic motor, just give you something kind of, you know, more basic that every phone has in exchange for better battery life, like the iPhone did. Like, I don't know. I know, Daniel, you're really big into good haptics on a phone. Like, would that be a deal breaker for you, or like would we all be down for better battery life in exchange for worse haptics?
Why would one be in this, you know,
haptic motors are big.
Yeah, I mean, like getting rid of the 3D touch or whatever it was called, force touch on the iPhone 11 series made room for a bigger battery.
Or yeah, why don't you just say in general, like, would you be willing to give up the forthcoming face unlock and motion gestures, or would you be willing to give up, you know, whatever else in the phone?
I don't need to do that. You just make a thicker phone. They've shown that that's possible too. Like the Pixel 3 does not have a haptic motor the way that an iPhone has, like a taptic engine. It's not as big. It's still a linear. It's a slightly more advanced, slightly bigger linear vibration motor, but it's still a traditional one that they just have much more access to. You don't need a massive haptic motor in a phone to actually have good haptics. You just need to be able to dig down to the driver level to manipulate it properly, which Google does. But I mean, to answer your question, so the Pixel 3a showed that you don't need a massive phone to have decent battery life on a Pixel. They can do it.
Mm-hmm.
We've seen it happen. I don't know if it's because it had a slower Snapdragon processor, or it did have a bigger battery than the Pixel 3, but not by much.
You couldn't squeeze it.
Yeah, I don't know. I think that, yes, I would sacrifice some things to get better battery life, but I would just rather make them, you know, have a bigger phone.
I mean, Hayato would sell his soul for a Pixel 4 that had all-day battery life. So really, giving up a hardware feature shouldn't be that big of a deal.
Fair enough.
I think the main issue here is that Google is still somehow not prioritizing battery life. Like, that is still the biggest question mark.
Which is just crazy. I agree. It's crazy.
That's the thing that makes no sense to me. That they can actually get away with this, or at least think they can get away with it.
We're talking about a 2800 milliamp hour battery in the Pixel 4.
Yeah, it's absurd.
Like, what year is it?
All three of us will be at the event next week. I'm really excited about it. We'll learn probably more than we've talked about on this podcast at the event. And then we will get to work reviewing all of the things, because that's how these things work. So
excited.
It's going to be fun. You can follow us all on Twitter. I'm at Journey Dan. Hayato, you're at Hayato Huseman. Andrew at Andrew Martinick. You can find us all at Android Central. And we'll be posting to Instagram throughout the entire event on Tuesday. I think I'm going to make Hayato do that, because he's the youngin' among us. Yeet. And
he's the quickest with the gram.
So you can find that at Android Central on Instagram. So keep up with us there. And that's it. I think we're going to leave it there for now. And we'll come back to you next week with our impressions of all the new hardware. Until then. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you later.
See ya.
Bye, everybody.